You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd Kenter Thomas & Parrish LLC and the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO. Since 1983, Boyd Kenter Thomas & Parrish Law Firm has emphasized its efforts in all types of labor law, union-related claims, and employment law disputes. The attorneys at BKTP have the experience and expertise to represent those who have been injured or killed in the workplace for hundreds of clients in both Missouri and Kansas. Visit our website at BKTPLaw to contact us for a free consultation. And the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO is the federation of 57 unions in the Missouri side of the Kansas City metro area, representing 12 million working people in all walks of life. It advocates for them with elected officials at City Hall, with employers and the media. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. Tonight on the show, Missouri's motto is "Let the welfare of the people be the supreme law," but the legislature still hasn't even passed Medicaid expansion. This week, or tonight, on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll talk to Jobs with Justice's Richard Von Glahn on a new coalition to use the initiative process to win health care coverage for thousands of Missourians. Then, we'll find out from Art Johnson, former president of the Social Security local in Kansas City, just how bad Trump's union busting of federal workers is. In the news, we'll have a report from the SEIU rally at Truman Medical Center. And why did ICE pick those Mississippi poultry plants to raid? Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. And now for the news. Now for the news from our side, August 15th, 2019. On Tuesday, about 75 members of the faith community, unions, Stand Up KC, Jobs with Justice, joined with Truman Medical Center workers to demand union recognition. The workers who are organizing are patient care techs, mental health techs, lab workers, and certified medical technicians. They want management to stop union busting, stop intimidation where they haul a worker in for a one-on-one with management. They called on management to agree to a fair and open process with no retaliation as they organize. The workers already have a majority support across their departments and are seeking to join the more than 350 TMC workers already represented by SEIU Healthcare Missouri. They want a voice at the table to address issues like short staffing, respect from management, and safety. One of the speakers at the rally was Terrence Wise from Stand Up KC. He asked why a McDonald's worker like him would care about the conditions for techs at Truman Medical Center. He answered himself by saying, "Because this is our hospital." He said one of his daughters was born there. His taxes help subsidize TMC. In fact, TMC gets over $36 million in annual subsidies from the city of Kansas City and Jackson County. They rely on public tax dollars for support, which they are using to interfere with workers' constitutional right to organize. The demonstration specifically targeted Charlie Shields, the TMC president and chief executive officer. Here's Shay Ross, a Truman Tech, calling Charlie out.
We were notified that we would get $500 bonus.
What?
I can use that money today. You can use that money today.
Yeah.
But what about tomorrow?
Yeah.
Yes.
What about when the smoke clears?
Yeah.
And after that, we need a fail-safe system.
Yeah. Right.
We need a fail-safe system going forward.
Yeah.
We need a union.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because a union, yeah. Because a union does not fight for the bonuses of today.
Right.
It goes beyond that. A union gives us a seat at the table with the ones who write those votes. So again, to our leadership, to Mr. Shields, thank you for the $500. But I'll see you that $500 and I'll raise you a union.
Zach Ford in Think Progress and Mike Elk at Payday Report both wrote about last week's raid by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which led to the arrest of nearly 700 workers at Seven Coke Food Incorporated poultry plants in Morton, Mississippi. Many were members of the UFCW, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Elk thinks the selection of Coke Foods, which, by the way, is not connected to the Kansas Koch brothers, may have an even more sinister motive than ICE's normal terroristic roundups of poor workers. In 2008, Coke Foods Incorporated settled a $3.75 million lawsuit brought by the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that alleged that supervisors at one of the raided plants touched and or made sexually suggestive comments to female Hispanic workers, hit Hispanic employees, and charged many of them money for normal everyday work activities. Many immigrant rights advocates have speculated that workers are targeted for raids after their facilities get investigated for worker abuse. Elk cites raids in Ohio and Tennessee, which occurred after workers complained of abuses. The UFCW, which represents many of these plant workers, is concerned these ICE raids will discourage workers from reporting abuse or unsafe conditions. This means employers like Coke Foods can rely on the fear of raids to help them exploit migrant workers already working in dangerous facilities without accountability for their other illicit labor conditions. Wednesday's raid was one of the biggest ICE raids in over a decade. It took place on the first day of school in Morton, meaning many children whose parents were detained had no family to go home to at the end of the day.
NBC News reports that the Trump administration on Wednesday unveiled a proposed rule that would greatly expand the religious exemption that allows religious entities to ignore anti-discrimination laws by broadening the definition to include federal contractors that declare themselves to be religious. The Department of Labor said the rule is proposed in order to provide, quote, the broadest protection of religious exercise, unquote, for companies that compete for federal contracts. LGBTQ advocates decried the proposed rule and said that it would permit companies to decline to hire lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people, in addition to individuals who do not practice their religion. Zeke Stokes, chief programs officer for GLAAD, the LGBTQ advocacy group, said, "This proposal is nothing more than a permission slip to discriminate." Jennifer C. Pizer, Lambda Legal's director of law and policy, says, "Given the conservative religious affiliations of many large institutional employers that seek federal contracts, we know that the most vulnerable workers will be LGBTQ people, as well as Muslims, Jews, and other religious minorities." The ACLU noted in a statement that nearly one quarter of the employees in the U.S. work for an employer that has a contract with the federal government. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel, Joyce McCauley, and I'm Jen Zaman.
I'm out.
That was the Bee Gees, Staying Alive, and we're talking about something that's very, very important. Welcome again to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Lon Swearingen, and our guest is Richard Von Galen, the Policy Director for Jobs with Justice. Our discussion is about Medicaid and its expansion. Richard, what is Medicaid, and who does it cover?
Medicaid is a federal state partnership that began in 1965, the same time as Medicare, but it is designed to provide health insurance to low-income people with disabilities, the blind, mothers with dependent children, a different segment of the population than Medicare. Often, Medicaid is known in Missouri as Missouri Health Net. Other states call it other things, but that's the program that we're talking about. Each state has the ability to set their own eligibility standards and determine what services are covered. So who exactly is covered by Medicaid varies from state to state.
Okay. How did it change under the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act was designed to increase access to affordable health care for more Americans. And one of the ways that they sought to do that in conjunction with the marketplace was to expand Medicaid eligibility. Unfortunately, opponents of access for health care sued, and the Supreme Court ruled that while the Affordable Care Act was constitutional, the provisions that required state expansion of Medicaid was not. So what has happened as a result is that 36 states, including the District of Columbia, have taken advantage of the fact that the Affordable Care Act provides dramatically increased federal funding to the state programs and have increased their eligibility to provide more health insurance to their citizens. Missouri is one of just 14 states that have not expanded coverage. And so the result in Missouri and those 14 states is there is what is known as the Medicaid gap. There are individuals who do not make enough money to qualify for subsidies in the federal marketplace, but they make too much money to qualify for Medicaid. In Missouri, as an example, if you are a single parent and you make more than $241 a month, you are deemed too wealthy to qualify for Medicaid at just $241 a month caring for a child. If you are a childless adult without a disability, you do not qualify for coverage, period. And so in Missouri, in states that haven't expanded, you have tens, hundreds of thousands of citizens who are left in the gap, too rich to qualify for Medicaid, too poor to qualify for federal subsidies in the marketplace.
We are basically discussing Medicaid and its expansion with Richard Von Galen, a policy director for Jobs with Justice on the Heartland Labor Forum. The question would be, what about Missouri? What should we do?
So Jobs with Justice, you know, we have been part of a broad coalition of hundreds of organizations that have called on the state to expand Medicaid for a number of years. That is because we believe very strongly that people shouldn't have to choose between paying their rent or paying their mortgage and paying for health insurance. We also know that by expanding Medicaid, we can bring tax dollars from Washington, D.C. back to Missouri and reinvest in our state and reinvest in our state infrastructure in a way that benefits our neighbors and our coworkers.
So with that, what has happened in rural Missouri that's really been a a disaster. Their hospitals, are they staying open, or what's going on with that?
There are a number of hospitals in rural Missouri that have either closed or had to cut back on services because in more lower income parts of our state where people are in the Medicaid gap, they are not able to, A, get preventative and more efficient care. And even when they do get care, they don't have health insurance, and so they can't pay for it. And that makes it very hard for healthcare providers to make ends meet.
Was there a difference before the Affordable Care Act was enacted with the Medicaid expansion? Was there a way that hospitals in rural Missouri were kept open? What was the deal with that? Do you remember?
Hospitals used to be a federal program that paid hospitals for uncompensated care and be part of that. Part of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act and part of what the hospitals supported is actually the elimination of that program, because uncompensated care, catastrophic care, is inefficient from a medical standpoint. So the elimination of that program in favor of Medicaid expansion and give people an access to have health insurance and use it in preventative ways and use it when they need it. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court ruled that Medicaid expansion couldn't be required and left it up to states to do it. Now, 36 states, including states run by Republicans and run by Democrats, have realized that this makes a lot of sense and is important to do and have chosen the path of expansion.
Is there a way that basically this could provide jobs for people if this expansion went on and developed as far as the health industry is concerned? I mean, is there a way that we would have money to employ people and things like that?
You know, healthcare is a thing that everybody needs.
Right.
And when you pump more money into the healthcare infrastructure supports a lot of jobs. Whether we're talking about ambulance drivers, you know, working in rural Missouri, or, nursing home workers, or nurses, or home healthcare workers, there's a lot of different jobs that can be impacted by having a vibrant and strong healthcare infrastructure and economy in our state.
So there this, and we may go in a little more, but how does more people having health insurance decrease costs? How's that work out?
Yep. So we know that far too many people have to make choices between healthcare needs and other life necessities. And so oftentimes they delay the preventative care, the signs that they need to go get something checked out, and they wait until what was maybe a $100 program becomes a $1,000 program. This is really bad for Missourians. But it also doesn't make sense economically, because when you wait until you have catastrophic needs, and if you're uninsured and you go into the hospital, well, the hospital is going to treat you. That's what hospitals are there to do. But then the hospitals have a lot of uncompensated care, and that makes it very hard for hospitals to survive. And so what do? They might eat some of those costs, but they pass some of those costs on to the insurance company. And the insurance company might choose to eat some of those costs, but they can't afford all of this uncompensated care. So they pass it on to an employer. And employers across this state have been having to wrestle with raising healthcare costs. And so they might continue to wrestle and maybe absorb some of those costs. And ultimately, it rolls down to working people. And that is why working people continue to struggle with rising healthcare costs, because having neighbors who are uninsured and are delaying the most efficient method of healthcare in favor of inefficient, catastrophic, expensive, uncompensated health insurance raises costs for everybody.
So with that, then I've heard that four hospitals in Missouri have already closed, and there are some that are about to. So what does this do as far as numbers, as far as numbers going in with a Medicaid expansion versus what it wasn't? Would there be available to other people? Is that how that works? And how does that structure work?
So I will point out that the citizens of Nevada just last week voted to increase their sales tax on themselves to pay to support their hospital. That's an incredible thing that people – and it passed, I believe, overwhelmingly. I believe it read by 89%.
Okay.
It wasn't close. The people of this state know that – we need our healthcare infrastructure. It is vital. It is a matter of life and death. And they're going out and, you know, making decisions as to try to how to do it. But the most efficient way to do this would be as a state to say, this is the proper thing. We want to support our infrastructure all across the state, not piecemeal, and do this. There are estimates that Missouri has lost as much as $1.5 billion so far by not having expanded. And that's a lot of money to leave on the table.
Right. So if we pass this, so that would that pump money in from the federal government, and how much basically would the Missouri have to pay involved with it? Is there a percentage?
Right. So states that expand Medicaid as part of the Affordable Care Act, there were a couple years that the federal government was going to pay 100% of the cost. And even when that was the case, the legislature didn't act. Right now, and actually forever forward, the Affordable Care Act says that the federal government will pay 90% of the cost of expansion. So for every dime the state puts in, 90 cents comes from the federal government. That's a pretty good deal. Much better than the deal that Missouri currently gets with our lower standards, that we pay 35 cents and the state puts in 65 cents. So we could actually, with the people that we're already paying at a higher rate for, see savings just right there.
Now, it affects... Basically, you're saying people with disabilities, those that are low income, parents or single parents that have children, and these kinds of things. So how would that work? How would they get that money, and how is it? Or is it just through the hospital itself?
So estimates are by expanding Medicaid in Missouri, it would impact about 219,000 Missourians. I think that includes 20,000 people who are near retirement age, over 50,000 parents. It would give them a tool that they could access to allow them to see primary care doctors, to go into the hospital, to be able to make sure that they can access the healthcare infrastructure and know that they've got a system to pay for it.
So is it balanced between the urban area and the rural area? How does that work?
So if you look at the numbers, I'm sure a lot of the places that are really struggling without this, there are a number of rural Missouri counties that are actually have a high number of low-income residents, of low-income residents. And obviously, Medicaid expansion would support a lot of people all across the state. But I think you would see a strong impact from Kansas City to Caruthersville, right, from Joplin up to Hannibal.
Well, there's more to this than that. What happens? All right, we'll switch a little gear here. What would happen if we went for Medicare for all? Would that solve some of the problem?
Well, Medicare for All is a different proposal than what's out there. What we know right now is that Medicaid and expanding Medicaid is an option that 36 other states have taken and has demonstrated proven results for the economies and for the people of that state. So we know that that is a program that we can access now, and we should take advantage to do that.
What happens if what being said that the Affordable Care Act, they pull the rug out from under it? Will Medicaid expansion be affected by that?
So we think it is critical to protect the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
The provisions that provide protections to a lot of families. When you saw the Affordable Care Act attacked in the early days of the Trump administration and people realized what they could lose, that was actually the most popular the Affordable Care Act has ever been. And so Jobs with Justice continues to fight to defend the Medicaid program at the federal level and the funding for it at the federal level, because we know it's critical. It's often the program that hundreds of thousands of people rely on to get access to health insurance.
This may be a little off because we're talking about Medicaid expansion, but the Affordable Care Act is very important. What did it do? How did it, when it came into effect, what was it supposed to do for the insurance of people? How did that work?
So the Affordable Care Act created a system in which anyone making over 100% of poverty could get federal subsidies to be in the marketplace, and then sought to expand Medicaid for people making under 100%. And there's a little overlap where the marketplace and Medicaid could both offer coverage. And the Affordable Care Act is working for people making over 100% of poverty. But because of the Supreme Court ruling, and that 14 states haven't expanded Medicaid, those states have populations where you can be too rich to qualify for the low standards on Medicaid that they have, but too poor to access the federal subsidies in the marketplace.
I've heard that they have these odd little insurance deals where you can get insurance, but it doesn't really work. Is that true? I mean, where you can pay for a policy, but it's not going to help if you really get into trouble.
I'm not sure about that. I know the Trump administration has sought to weaken the standards that companies have to provide within the plans in the marketplace, and the Affordable Care Act sought to have quality standards to make sure that people weren't getting junk insurance plans that then weren't there when they need them.
And what I'm going to ask, and this is something, because I've heard some rumors, or not rumors, but actually that we are going to push to put something on the ballot to help with this. What is that about?
You know, there have been a couple states that have been frustrated with legislative inaction and have turned to the citizen initiative petition process to move that forward. Our neighbors in Nebraska did that in 2018. I think you have seen in Missouri that citizens can use that process to move their values forward when the legislature fails to. You saw that in the repeal of Right to Work, the increase in the minimum wage, the passing of Clean Missouri to clean up our government.
Right.
And, you know, we are exploring using that same process to potentially put a Medicaid expansion issue on the ballot as well.
Okay. I was just curious. And, Richard, I really thank you for doing this. It's a really important thing that we have to do in Missouri. So I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. And is there anything you want to say, the last thing you want to say?
So if anyone's interested in any of the work around Medicaid expansion at the federal defense level or potential work going forward, you can look us up. Our website is www.mojwj.org. Again, that's www.mojwj.org. Or anyone is happy to reach out to me, you can email me. It's quite simple, richard@mojwj.org.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Lon.
Really appreciate it.
I was at the station one day, and I heard a gentleman say that he is part Native American. And while he doesn't practice or focus in on any on his particular tribe or, I guess, get involved in the community that much, one thing he does do is tune in to Native Spirit on Sundays with Rhonda Lovaldo. And he said that makes him feel connected. And when I heard his story, I thought, and that's why I volunteer at KKFI.
Hi, all. This is Leslie Pores, Vice President of the Board here at KKFI. I want you to consider becoming an active member here at the station. Active members are the people who volunteer an average of 4 hours a month. And when you become an active member, you have a vote on all the major decisions of the station. Community radio at its best. We only fulfill our mission of serving the community when it reflects your voice. Come on down and get involved.
They can't cheat us. They won't shake us. They can't beat us, they won't break us. They've tried it all before, with their tricks and legal wars. And there's nothing they can do, 'cause we're unions through and through.
This is Joyce McCauley, and we are welcoming Arthur Johnson, previous president of the American Federation of Government Employees. In fact, he was he served that position longer than anyone else, 35 years. When he retired, he was named president emeritus, and he's still working and fighting for unions and fighting for the cause. Welcome, Art. We're so glad to have you. And I'd like us to talk a little bit about the executive orders that were presented by Trump a year ago, and the kind of the process, what happened with that. I do want to ask, before we get into too much of the history of that, is the first one was talking about the standardized, the length, the performance improvement plans at 30 days. I didn't quite understand what that meant.
Well, what it meant was employees would be given an improvement plan. And they reduced the time that the employees had to improve. And if they didn't improve within that amount of time, then they would either suspend them or discharge them.
Okay, so that basically, it took the right away from the worker to do a better job because
Correct.
They didn't have as much
right.
time to work on whatever the deficit
right.
was that they said. Okay. So the executive orders went down a year ago, and a couple of months after that, a judge said that that was not in a line with the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978, and they could not go along with it.
That's correct.
And then the Trump administration did their appeal, and then the one that came down recently.
Right. The appeal just about gave the agency, well, the Trump administration, what they had wanted.
So then that actually had an effect on the contract negotiations between the Social Security Administration and the AFGE.
Right. During all this time, we had been at the table trying to negotiate, and this put a halt to that. And while we were trying to negotiate, management was trying to implement the executive orders, even though we had won the case when it went to court.
Uh-huh.
And they're still trying to do it.
It just seems strange they can actually implement something that the court said, no, you can't do it.
Well, they had letters from management, the agency rather, telling them that they wanted them to put the things in the contract. In fact, I think OPM had to review some of the contracts before they could even present them to us at the table. I mean, it's weird.
So it really got, and then one of the things that was in the executive order, and then was also, it looked like one of the areas that was not able to be settled by your regular negotiations was the use of official facilities and communications, and the big one was official union time and time to do union work and then time off and stuff.
Right. Regarding the facilities, we were, the executive order restricted our use of official, it restricted the use of any management facilities. We couldn't use the rooms that we had been using for umpteen years, their telephone system, the computers, the printers, all of that was off limits for us.
So what did you do when all that happened, came down?
Well, at the time, we were in a limbo as to what we could do. People had their computers at home, and we had two or three laptops that we were able to continue to do the union business that way.
Okay, so you just pretty much had to set up some home offices and use your own equipment.
Right, right.
Okay, what also, how does this affect the, not only the executive order, but then your contract and your, you know, as you were working through it, how did it affect arbitration and negotiations?
Well, during this time, management implemented, they proposed in the things that were in the executive order, and that's what ended up going to impasse. After we went to impasse, the impasse panel went down the list, and just about everything, they accepted management's position.
And the impasse panel is the, that's a group of people that's actually appointed by the president.
They are appointed by each administration, and the current administration has all the slots, so when we go to impasse, it's a lost cause.
It's they're already on the side of the executive orders and whatever the president wants. And this group can't even be, they're not even confirmed by the Senate. I mean, they're
they're just selected by the president.
And so they're not really an organization that can do negotiations that should be fair and to both sides.
Well, I'm not sure exactly how it's set up, but under the when Kennedy had his executive order, this is the group that was supposed to be the final arbiter, so to speak. When you went to there, they would resolve whatever they did. That was final as far as your contract. Now, under the system with the executive orders, I believe AFGE National is going to take that these things that they to court. And in fact, I think they've already gone to court. And the problem with that is there's really no court to handle it. So one court has refused to take it, and I'm not sure what the next step is.
That's what, yeah, that's, it was the couple articles that I read indicated that the union did want to go ahead and fight some more, but if they go back to the original court, if they're turned down by that court, I think the next place they can go is the Supreme, and that it depends if they want to even take it.
It could be. I'm not sure.
That was this couple things I read kind of indicated.
But it seems like that's the only thing left, it would appear. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they've already gone to those higher courts, and they went to the three-judge panel who said that the executive order can stand, so that's pretty much the only place they have left to go.
You were correct.
Which is probably not happy news for the people. How is this over? This has got to affect so many people. I mean, you know, the numbers I'm looking at, 700,000 in the AFGE and out of 2.1 million of federal workers. You know, this affects a great number of people and their ability to work and in a fair and just environment.
Well, the Veterans Administration, they're going through the same thing. The only thing that is saving some of the agencies is their contract has not expired yet, so they haven't had to go through this yet.
Okay, and there, and then, and if they do go through that, there was something, and was it the executive order about the end of a contract, that it would automatically.
That what?
That it would automatically reverse to this executive order kinds of.
Oh yes, once their contract expired, the new contract would have to be in the guidelines with the three executive orders.
So they've got. One of the executive orders said they would streamline collective bargaining negotiations. What exactly does that mean?
That's what we got here in the Federal Service Impasse Panel. That's what they call streamlining.
Okay.
Whatever the agency submits to them, the agency usually is going to win.
Okay, which means they don't. I think we were talking earlier, they don't have time to do the research they need when there is some kind of a grievance out there.
We have not decided how we're going to handle that. Now, probably we're going to have to do some of the research at home,
mm-hmm.
Because we're going to be limited to the amount of leave without pay we can even take. They're restricting that to 80 hours a year. So,
it's as if this administration has said, we don't want unions to function, so we're going to take the time away they need to function. We're going to limit any kind of equipment they need to function. So basically, they're trying to get
they're trying to put us out of business.
Exactly,
right.
by doing that kind of stuff. How is this going to affect the whole federal workers overall? I mean,
well, I don't really think the workers themselves understand, and we probably need to do a better job of explaining to them, because one of the executive orders was aimed at employees, that they were going to have to do be under more scrutiny. They will have to I know one of the things, they'll be under more scrutiny. And my mind has gone blank on me here.
I know the one talked about the 30 days.
They'll be holding them accountable for their performance and conduct is one of the things in the deal. Each employee will be their work performance and disciplinary history will be calibrated to where they will be under the under more strict control of the supervisors. Let's see here. Oh, one of the big things that is that they won't be required to use discipline, progressive discipline. They can go straight to firing.
I know I'm a retired teacher, and I know our union, if someone was on a growth plan of some kind,
mm-hmm.
they had so many days, and if any part of the plan was met, then they got another 30 days to go and continue.
Yeah.
So it sounds like what's happening here is you got the 30 days, and unless everything is okay, they could get fired.
Right.
Or put on leave.
Right. They, they're trying to make it, one of the complaints they have nationwide is that you can't fire government employees.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this executive order is geared to make it easier to fire federal employees. So,
and that goes with the streamlining of the collective bargaining, reducing the number of work hours, exempting personnel actions from, and that it sounds like Trump would really like it if the personnel that work for the government couldn't even file a grievance. It sounds like he's really interested
well,
in doing that.
Well, that was one of the things that the they're trying to eliminate what is grievable.
Now, those things that are grievable, aren't those decided between the actual company and the union?
That's the way they're supposed to be. But when the impasse panel got a hold of the grievance procedure, see, they made some changes in that. They said they prohibit grievance arbitration for removals, suspensions, and with union wanted status quo, but that they adopted the they adopted the union's proposal. They said the agency didn't meet the legal burden. So we did get the suspensions for more than 14 days, the furloughs of 30 days, and so forth.
Well, so that was, that was one thing that
that was
able to stay. It sounds like they gave you a couple of things. That sounds to me like the main thing that happened is they're taking away your ability to run the union and, you know, make it work for all the workers.
Well, that's for sure. And they, regarding promotions, the union wanted to expand the area of consideration to where more employees could be considered for promotion. And the Federal Service Impasse Panel adopted the agency's proposal where they would have a limited area of consideration on the best qualified list.
So what we have just a couple of minutes left. Is there anything that you want to add to or anything you want to let our listeners know that they need to start paying attention and listening to? I feel like sometimes we're not listening and talking about the right things in terms of our government and what's going on.
Regarding the official time cutback, we have about 50,000 employees in the Social Security Administration.
Mm-hmm.
They want to limit the hours of official time that we can use to 50,000, which means that leaves we can spend 1 hour on each federal employee for the complete year, which is impossible.
Well, it's not enough. It's not enough to meet the needs of the of the workers within the government.
One thing I would like to comment on: if we're going to be stuck with the executive order as is and have to represent all employees, then all employees should be required to pay a service fee, or we should only be required to represent those employees who are members of our union.
Oh, that's true.
Yep.
That's true. If that, you're right. If that comes to pass, then all the members are going to have to contribute.
Right.
I know that they don't have to now.
They don't have to now.
And you still have to represent them.
But that would be the trade-off. We cannot have, we cannot represent all employees in the bargaining unit if we don't have official time or they're not paying any dues at all.
Right, right. So, well, I just want to thank you so much for coming and helping us unwrap this this information, not only on the executive order, but the way that your contract was eventually finalized and with the this impasse committee.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's another piece of the political puzzle, I think, that a lot of people aren't aware of. So I really thank you for helping us unwrap all of this and talk about this. And and I hope that you are able to do more. And I know you're still involved, and, and I hope you're able to do more to help the federal workers move out of this and you know, become a little bit more, not under the, you know, the guise of this executive order.
Well, hopefully there's a court that will hear our action that we're taking to go to court on the impasse panel decision.
Okay, very good. Again, thank you very much. Arthur Johnson from the Social Security Agency, past president of the union and still active, still going.
Stand up for your right. up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I want to talk to you about a change in immigration law that has hit the news just recently that everybody's talking about. It is this administration's change to what's called the public charge rule. On August 14th of this week, just yesterday, the Department of Homeland Security published the final rule related to the public charge in the Federal Register. Now, this was announced sometime last year, and then they took comments on it. This is the final rule. It isn't set to take effect until October 15th of 2019, and a number of organizations and states have already made filings in court in order to challenge this. So this new rule interprets a provision of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which is the law related to immigration in the United States, and it's pertaining to inadmissibility. The inadmissibility ground at issue says that a person is inadmissible, that means unable to come into the United States, if they are likely to become a public charge. This law only applies to individuals seeking admission to the United States or applying for adjustment of status. This provision isn't going to affect all immigrants that are coming in, but it will affect many. It also does not, at this point, change any rules that apply to naturalization, which is something that you can get after you have been a lawful permanent resident for 3 to 5 years. Currently, the law says that a person who is an intending immigrant into the United States, either applying at the consulate or applying in the United States to what's called adjust status, which means change from one status to that of a lawful permanent resident. Currently, it says that the public charge, that officers must decide whether or not someone's a public charge by evaluating whether a person who is an applicant for a green card and also certain people who are seeking entrances on certain types of visa is likely to become primarily dependent on the government for support. Primary dependence refers to reliance on cash aid for income support like SNAP or food stamps programs, welfare, those types of things. Something that's called means-tested benefits, meaning that you have to make under a certain amount of money in order to be able to qualify. Right now and in the past, how an officer determined this was by looking at something called an affidavit of support, which is a contract that is signed by the intending immigrant sponsor. So usually a member of their family, like their mom, their dad, their brothers or sisters, depending on who is applying, or their children, if it's a child applying for a parent. The government in the past has looked at this contract to find if the sponsor has enough money or makes enough money or has enough assets in order to assure the government that the intending immigrant is not going to rely primarily on cash assistance from the government in order to live. Additionally, in right now, publicly funded healthcare, nutrition, housing programs are not currently considered negative factors when they're evaluating whether or not someone will become a public charge. However, under these new rules, beginning on October 15th, they will consider these benefits and they may, in fact, impact someone's ability to become a new resident. The main difference is that now, instead of assessing whether or not an applicant is likely to become primarily dependent on the government for support, the new rule defines public charge as a person who receives any number of public benefits for more than an aggregate of 12-month period over any 36-month period. So each of these benefits used, which in the past may not have even been considered a public charge benefit, could count negatively for the person who's intending the immigrant. For example, under the new rule, Medicaid, SNAP, Section 8 housing, and federally subsidized housing would be used as evidence that a green card applicant is inadmissible for this public charge. Also, this rule also elaborates and allows the agents who were evaluating this to consider other factors like the financial status of the family size, the person's age, their education, their skills, and their employability, and also whether or not they speak English as a factor to determine whether or not, in the officer's opinion, they think the person is likely to become a public charge. This is a very big change, and a lot of people are going to be impacted. If you or a friend or a family member are someone who is applying for benefit of entering the United States as a permanent resident, I would highly recommend that you consult with an immigration attorney in order to determine if you are going to be negatively impacted by this rule. That's all the time we have for today, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams from the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Stay safe.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. The Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast will be this coming Saturday, August 17th, 8:15 for breakfast and 9 o'clock for the speaker. This is at Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue in KCK. The speaker is Nancy Boyda, who's running for Senate, and the Kansas Democratic Party Executive Director, Ben Mears. Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, August 19th, 5 to 8 p.m. at El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, KCK. Pushing Back, Marching Forward, Women's Equality Week is from August 22nd to August 29th. For a schedule of all of their events, go to Women's Equality GKC on Facebook. IWW Organizer Training 101, August 24th, 8:30 a.m. to August 25th, it's a Saturday and Sunday, 4 p.m. at SEIU Local 1, 4501 Paseo. Register at Kansas City IWW on Facebook. That's the wrong address. I think it's 4523 Paseo. Impeach Trump Now, mass rally and march, Saturday, August 24th, 4 to 6 p.m., Mill Creek Park, 43rd and Broadway, Kansas City, Missouri, sponsored by United We Stand KC, the Sunrise Movement, Indivisible KC, and United We Dream. Heartland Alliance for Progress Immigration Update, Monday, August 26th, 5:15 to 7 p.m. at the KCPT Building, 125 East 31st Street in Kansas City. And finally, Troublemaker School Organizing Training. This is on Sunday, September 14th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on the University of Kansas campus. For more information, go to labornotes.org/Kansas. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called Labor for Sustainability Convergence. Thanks to tonight's engineer. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.